Washington Health and Aging Organizations, working on policies and funding for stem cell research, Alzheimer's disease research, support for the National Institute on Aging, and other issues. Batting second and in the middle is Joshua Weiner, PhD. Josh has been in all the places that us as journalists have turned to for information over the years. Right now, he is Senior Fellow and Program Director for Aging at Disability and Long-Term Care at RTI International, which is a research and consulting group that concentrates on health and education and a lot of other stuff, Josh has told me. Before joining RTI, he did policy analysis and research for the Urban Institute, Brookings Institution, the Healthcare Financing Administration, which was the predecessor to our favorite agency, CMS, CBO, and other agencies. He's the author and editor of, editor of 8 books and over 100 articles on healthcare for older people, people with disabilities, long-term care, Medicaid, health reform, healthcare rationing, and maternal and child health. And his current research includes studies of Medicaid, home, and community-based services, the long-term care workforce, quality assurance for long-term care. He's co-director of the Administration on Aging-funded Alzheimer's Disease Demonstration Grants. And we won't hold it against him, but he received his doctorate and master's degrees from Harvard and his bachelor's degree from the University of Chicago. And batting cleanup, figuratively to my left, is Jenny Chin Hansen, who really couldn't be better suited for this panel. Her staff tells me that she is the first baby boomer president-elect of AARP. Jenny is a healthcare executive and career nurse. For 25 years, she worked as a researcher, program administrator, and then executive director at Unlock Senior Health Services in San Francisco. That innovative healthcare program provides medical, therapy, and social services, including home-based and transportation services, which help older people remain in their homes. And like many of us, Jenny grew frustrated that state and federal programs provided incentives for nursing homes but not community care. So she and others helped persuade Congress in 97 to pass the Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly, a.k.a. PACE, which makes Medicare and Medicaid funding available to support community-based health programs. She recently returned to teach nursing at San Francisco State University and to work on patient safety as a senior fellow at UCSF and to devote more time to her volunteer efforts with AARP and as a federal commissioner for the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission. I am going to now shut up and get out of the way, and we're going to lead off with Dan. You all set?
Okay, can everyone hear me? Thanks very much for that introduction, Dave, and it's a pleasure to be back with the press. What my colleagues and I are going to do over the next 45 minutes or so is to give you a look ahead, pierce the veil, look into the future of what we're going to experience as a rapidly aging society, not unlike much of the developed world, but all things are local today, and so we're going to be talking largely from a U.S. perspective. And because we're in Washington, D.C., I'm sure all of us at one point or another will touch a little bit about federal policy, and then we'll take your questions. But as we think about the health of the baby boom generation, and as I look around and I see a few of you out there, it seems to me that it might be useful to start with sort of getting in touch with our own psychology as we think about ourselves as baby boomers going through the life cycle. And so I want to start with a few slides that will help you put yourself in that frame of mind as we think about what this is all about. Okay. Okay. Well, that's one way to think about aging, I suppose. But indeed, it's true, and I don't know where you find yourself on that spectrum, but nevertheless, that gets you in the frame of mind. As Americans, we are obsessed with aging, getting older, retaining youth, whichever way you want to take a look at it. Go into Borders or Barnes & Noble and go to the health section, which is one of the longer sections, And if you really look at what's behind those titles, they're really talking about aging these days. There's not a whole lot about childhood and other times in life. They're really talking about aging. Why? Because the biggest population bubble in American history is now, the leading edge of which is less than 3 years away from hitting age 65. And much of my talk will be about what the health consequences of that are going to be. So this, I could have chosen a title from Parade magazine at the very popular end, or I could have chosen a medical journal. They're all talking about the same thing. So I picked sort of a middle of the road. And here's another middle of the road, not just the science of aging, but the practical matters of how does one get to age 100 and not regret it once you get there? So baby boomers are beginning to think living a long time and how to get there. And I should add that we're not the first generation to have ambitions for living long and living well and having everything that we want. It's just that our parents and grandparents' generation had a slightly lowered time perspective. So this is from a paperback magazine or book, the very big seller back in the 30s and 40s, Life Begins at 40. And as you read this, it's a real hoot because the premise is, okay, you've made it to 40, you know, you're shot. You know, maybe if you're lucky with power of positive thinking, you could eke out another 10 years. But by and large, they saw things as having rather tighter limits. And so this hip, svelte couple that you see striding boldly into the future is doesn't think that they've got all that much going for them. Part of my job as the first speaker is giving you the big perspective. Well, this is the biggest perspective there is. In the last 100 years, we have added more years to average life expectancy than was added in the previous 5,000 years going back to the Iron Age. So if you go back to prehistoric man, you see from what we know from analyzing bones and so forth, average life expectancy, very low. And in fact, even in the United States before 1900 or at 1900, the average life expectancy for men and women, less than 50. But from the middle of the 19th century forward, we've been adding, when I say we, I now mean westernized, industrialized nations, about 2 years of average life expectancy for every decade. So actually, I'm giving you a little bit of a beat on a story. The average life expectancy today is 77.8 years, but by the time they finish doing the analysis at the end of this year, it'll be 77.9. Pretty quick, we're going to hit 80 and then perhaps beyond. Of course, this is a blend of male and female. For the men in the audience, average life expectancy for birth today, 75.2 baby girls born today, already over 80 years. And that's in the U.S., much higher in Japan, much lower in some of the nations of the third world. But what this all adds up to in terms of numbers in the U.S., we currently have about 37 million Americans over the age of 65. In terms of national health expenditures, because we know older people tend to use health services more than younger people, we're now at $2.3 trillion. That's very current figures. We're on our way to $3 trillion even before the first baby boomer turns age 65 in 2011. And then, and I don't have this up there, but the expectations are that by 2016 we will hit $4 trillion. And you can march that out a few more decades and see what the impact is going to be. Because we know that those with chronic conditions, and that is now nearly half of all Americans and two-thirds of those over the age of 65 are already accounting for about three-quarters of every dollar of those $2.3 trillions, and almost half of Americans already have one chronic condition. Of the 65 and over, like I say, it's about two-thirds. Almost 80% have two-thirds have two or more chronic conditions. And with aging, we know that the ability to perform activities of daily living. This is a term that gerontologists and geriatricians use. But it means being able to feed yourself, bathe yourself, use the toilet, carry on activities of being able to live independently. And at 65 to 74, that decade or near decade, over 80% have no diminishment of their ability to carry out activities of daily living. In the next decade into the middle 80s, you'll see that red line of having some difficulty starts to rise. And after age 85, it's pretty much a 50-50 proposition that people will have difficulties in carrying out basic living. Here's the big cost items. They're all chronic diseases. They're all associated with aging. Cardiovascular disease and stroke. This is an estimate for the current year. As you can see, we're approaching $500 billion for cardiovascular disease. Alzheimer's disease, currently there are estimated 4.5 million Americans with this devastating condition, extraordinarily costly because of the long period of time, several years, that people with the disease need round-the-clock care. That's now estimated at $174 billion in both direct and indirect costs, cancer, diabetes, and you can see the rest. By the way, cancer among the older population will quadruple by 2050, and diabetes will increase proportionately as well. That's all before the baby boomers turn 65. The first one will get a notice from AARP probably on January 1st, 2011, welcoming them to join. Yes, you do. That's true. But at 65, the numbers will go from about 6,000 Americans a day able to get those notices to 10,000 a day after 2011. So you can see what a huge jump. And then we'll stay at 10,000 a day turning 65 for the next 18 years. That's the size of the bubble, the so-called pig in the python that represents the baby boom generation. And that will begin very soon. So if we look at past trends and assume steady state, that the incidence of chronic disease, the lack of ability to care for oneself independently, will continue in proportion, we are expecting to see overall health expenditures reach $16 trillion by the year 2030, which is really not that far off when you think about it, but it's the year when even the youngest baby boomer will be age 65. Over 76 million people eligible for Medicare, more than double what it is today, and 171 million Americans with a chronic health problem. The costs of lost independence are one of the great hidden costs of healthcare in America. A few years ago, Josh Weiner and I and a few others put together a document that showed how much the costs are magnified from a person on Medicare over 65 who is reasonably independent and able to care for themselves to that same person if they need some additional help with activities of daily living, and that same person if they need to be institutionalized even for part of the year. And I don't put the slide up anymore because the numbers are out of date. They are much higher than they were when we did that, and perhaps we ought to look for a way to update all of that. But I can tell you that the cost of the average cost of health care for a Medicare recipient today is about $7,000 if they need any help over the course of a year with activities of daily living. That quadruples. And if they need any time at all in a facility of long-term care, it goes up about 8 times. And both Josh and Jenny will talk a little bit later about long-term care, but you start to get the idea. There have been hundreds of studies in the last few years charting the impact of chronic disease, which is now the overwhelming driver of health costs in our country, over the last few years. What the impact is today, what it will be in the future, and what the impact will be with the aging of the population. My organization, the Alliance for Aging Research, about a year ago, pulled all of those studies together. This is from private research think tanks like RAND. It's from major universities. It's government-funded research, academic research, some from industry, some from private think tanks like RAND. And we extracted the essential insight of each of hundreds and hundreds of these studies on chronic disease, boiled them down into a single document, set those individual insights out by cancer, cardiovascular disease, neurological disease, and diabetes. We called it the Silver Book, and then we took it online, which it is today, and the numbers of studies and the factoids that are in there have increased exponentially. Any of you doing stories about chronic disease and its impact now and in the future, if you want quick, at your fingertips, access to the distilled information of hundreds and hundreds of these studies, I recommend to you to go to silverbook.org. And in the back of the room before you leave, there's a card back there that tells you how to get to it, what's in it. We just brought out a new volume recently on vision loss and the impact that that's having. We will roll out further studies in the future, but that's something that I offer to you. Let me take just a moment before I wrap up to talk about how poorly prepared we are in terms of healthcare delivery, in terms of healthcare professionals. We have 144 medical schools in the United States. Every one of them has a full department of pediatrics. Anybody want to guess how many have a full department of geriatrics? Less than half. The number is five. And 5 years ago, there was one. So we're starting in the most feeble way possible to make geriatric medical education a priority. Now, about 20% of those schools have a division within a department of internal medicine or family practice that does a pretty good job in geriatrics. Yes?
Do you know the data on nurse practitioner programs?
Yes, I'm going to get to that. That's the next slide. You're jumping ahead, but you're right. It's not just doctors. It's nurses. It's pharmacists. It goes across the health professions. But it's really shocking that the vast majority of physicians graduating from U.S. medical schools and the others this year will not have had a single hour's course in geriatrics. Now, they may pick up some of this in internal medicine or something else, but there really is no focus whatsoever. Here's the numbers. Out of 100,000 medical school faculty, only 600 list geriatrics as a specialty. There's out of about 650,000 U.S. physicians, a little over 7,000 that list geriatric, that have an advanced degree in geriatrics. That's about 8%, and it's falling because those that have the certificates are getting out. They're retiring. They feel that they can't make a living because, while if you're in general practice, you can afford to have a certain percentage of your patients paid for by Medicare, which pays below market. But if your entire practice is, it's very difficult. Now to the lady's question, less than 1% of nurses in the U.S. certified in geriatrics. Here's the number that shocks me when you think about misuse of medications in the elderly. Out of 200,000 pharmacologists in the U.S., 200,000, 720. That's some fraction of a half of a percent have a certificate in geriatrics. This is a great untold story in my view. It gets told from time to time sporadically, but I think it deserves a lot more attention. Now, what are the consequences of this? Well, the RAND-ACOV study found that this meant that less than 40% of the time an older patient is getting the recommended approved response to whatever their particular needs are. They're not getting the preventive care. We do a great job in telling young people and people at working age to stop smoking, to exercise, to diet. After 65, we figured, well, they're on Medicare. Like, they don't need to have incentives for health promotion. Less likely to receive the appropriate or complete medical care. Much higher risk to the medication-related errors that many of you have written about. and they're not part of the drug trial. So they're the greatest users of the drugs, but we're testing those drugs on people in their 30s. I'm going to close with this because, as I said, we're going to talk a little bit about policy. I find it very encouraging that there's now a coalition called the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease. It's over 100 organizations, academic, patient group, labor organizations, big employers. Richard Carmona, the former Surgeon General, is the chair. It's the leadership. This comes from both Republicans and Democrats alike, trying to put on the agenda of the presidential candidates a greater emphasis on looking at the numbers that I've been talking about chronic disease, and trying to find ways to intervene to deal with those chronic diseases and keep people functioning longer. Legislation that was introduced very recently by Senator Barbara Boxer of California goes at some of these issues of lack of exposure of health professionals in their training to geriatrics. Senator Lincoln of Arkansas has introduced legislation again to try to improve reimbursement and other things to draw people into geriatrics. But once again this year, the pitifully small amount that is in HHS appropriations for professional training in geriatrics, about $30 million out of a how many trillion dollar budget, cut again, zeroed out again. It was zeroed out in 2006, then through extraordinary efforts of some advocacy groups, geriatric training got back in 07 and 08. It's out again in 09. This is the kind of thing that that many of us are fighting. I hope I've stayed reasonably within my time. I'll wrap up and hope to talk to you later. Thanks.
Thanks, Dan. That was great. While Josh is getting set up, does anyone have a quick question for Dan while we're in between speakers? Go right ahead. Had a feeling.
Is the proposed budget cut of $30 million, is financing the only reason why medical nursing schools and pharmacy schools are not doing geriatric programs?
No.
Can you state some of the other reasons?
Yes. The other reasons are that young physicians and nurse students do not see this as a viable career course. There is a bias, even among young people, guess what, to treating old people that they perceive as being terminally ill, they're going to die anyway, it's not exciting medicine. So low economics, low status, and most medical schools are very political places where the monies that are there to be distributed tend to go to high technology fields of medicine where there are procedures that can be reimbursed by various by insurers or others, and so much of geriatrics is sort of low tech, high touch that there's not a lot of reimbursement mechanisms. So it becomes complicated. It's another reason why folks like you want to dig into it through this story.
But just to follow up, is we know that the primary care options for primary care are also decreasing.
That's so right. Geriatrics is within primary care. And let me make a point. No one is, that I know of, is advocating that there be a new primary care specialty called geriatrics that everybody who sees an old patient needs to have a certificate. No. But we need to have far more training, more required courses, more required rotations in nursing homes and so on for people who are going to be in family practice and internal medicine.
I saw we had a couple more, but I want to make sure everybody has time to talk. So let's let Josh get rolling, and please hold the rest of the questions till we get clear. Thanks, Josh. Okay.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Just following up on this last question, the Institute of Medicine has a report that will be coming out on April 14th, which is the report of a committee that I happen to be on that specifically addresses the health workforce for an aging society. So I encourage you all to either attend the press conference or look at the press release when it comes out. This has been a year effort to try to address some of the issues of the healthcare workers for this aging society. Well, first, let me welcome you all to Washington. Washington, you know, is the home of policy wonks, but not everybody here in Washington is a policy wonk. I was talking to someone just the other day who thought that Roe versus Wade was George Washington's choice for crossing the Delaware. And, you know, Washington's also a place where economists have a lot of power. You all know what the definition of an economist is, don't you? It's someone who finds something that works in the real world and wonders if it would work in theory. So, okay. So Dan set up a lot of things in terms of aging. I'm going to be focusing primarily on long-term care. With the reduction of infectious diseases, there's been a rise in chronic diseases. Dan talked about that at some length. We have aging of the population here in the United States, as well as across the world. And with increased longevity, you get a rise of chronic illnesses, and with that, you get an increase in disability. So long-term care is a way of trying to deal with that decline in function, the increase in disability. It tries to provide people with ways to compensate for that loss of function rather than focusing on the cure. So long-term care services includes a range of services, including nursing homes, assisted living, home care, home health care, adult daycare, and so on. So in my time today, I'd like to talk about four big issues. One, what will happen to demand for long-term care as the baby boomers age? Who should pay for long-term care? What should be the balance between institutional care, such as nursing homes, and home and community-based services? And then finally, who will provide the care in the future in terms of long-term care? So starting with this first question of what's going to happen to the demand for long-term care, currently we have just under 10 million people with some kind of disability, and contrary to what many people think, most people who have a disability are in the community rather than in nursing homes, 7.9 million in the community versus 1.6 million in nursing homes. And also, despite the fact that we're focusing on the elderly population and baby boomers as they become elderly, approximately a third of the population with disabilities is in fact under the age of 65 and are an important in terms of their need for long-term care services and for long-term care expenditures. As Dan pointed out, disability rates increase sharply with age. You really can't talk about the elderly population as a single group. Once you get to 85, it's almost half the population with some form of disability. Well, this is basically a projection of the American population between 2000 and 2050. And unless you've been in a coma for the last 50 years, you know that the elderly population is going to be increasing substantially, 147%. The population age 85 and older, which is that group most likely to need long-term care, is going to increase much more rapidly, 386% over that 50-year period. But if you look at that under 65 population, I don't think that's gotten anywhere near as much attention, because over the next 50 years, the percentage increase in that population, which is essentially your working age population, is projected to increase only 35%, less than 1% a year, and much of that is through immigration and not through births by people who are American citizens. So that is really what is historically unique. We've had large increases in the elderly population before, but this incredible slowdown in the growth in the working population is really what's driving a lot of the problems in the future in terms of having financial support for Medicare, for Social Security, for Medicaid, but that's not getting the attention I think it deserves and something that you might want to think about. So when you put all those factors together, the growth in the elderly population, the very strong relationship between disability and older age, 85 and older, the projections that I've done suggest that the number of people receiving paid home care will increase from about 2.2 million in 2000 to 5.3 million in 2040. The number of people in nursing homes will increase from 1.2 million in 2000 to about 2.7 million in 2040. So how should long-term care be financed? Well, one of the things we need to do is not be focused solely about in the United States, but look across to other countries. And this is some data from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development about expenditures for long-term care as a percent of gross domestic product. And so, as you can see, for most countries, it's about 1.3, 1.2, 1.9 percent of gross domestic product. You have Sweden as an outlier out there at 2.89 percent. And you've got Ireland down here at 0.62 percent, which reflects both that they don't have that many older people, but also they don't have much in the way of services. And the purple part of the bar is the public expenditures, and the yellow is the private. And what you can see is that in the vast majority of the countries, the public sector is the overwhelming source of financing for long-term care. The United States is here, and it has a higher proportion of private expenditures than other countries. But even in the United States, the public expenditures dominate the long-term care expenditures. So looking at how some of the other countries finance long-term care, Germany has a universal provides universal coverage through a social insurance program. Japan has a similar program, but it limits coverage to people who are elderly or people who have elderly type illnesses. But in England, at the other end of the continuum, they have a mostly means-tested program administered at the local level, which in many ways is a reflection of the kind of system that we have here in the United States. So these are some projections of elderly spending for long-term care as a percent of the gross domestic product that I did some years ago. I project it will go from about 1.36% of the gross domestic product up to about 2.1% of gross domestic product in 2048. If I were to be redoing these estimates now, I'd probably put it at about 2.5% now. So how you look at this is really kind of a Rorschach test. The glass can be either half full or half empty. If you're an optimist, you say, well, you know, we're going to have this huge increase in the elderly population, but we're only talking about adding another percent, maybe a percent and a half, to the gross domestic product in terms of expenditures. During the 90s, we added a couple of percentage points to national health expenditures and barely skipped a beat. So if you're an optimist, you say, this is going to be an extra burden, but we can deal with it. But if you're a Medicaid director and you're saying that basically the cost of long-term care is going to double, you go into shakes and you get depressed and you worry a lot about how you're going to raise the revenue to finance that long-term care expenditures. And of course, it's not just long-term care, it's long-term care in combination with Medicare and Social Security and a number of other things. So This is an estimate from CBO of long-term care expenditures in 2004 for the older population, about $135 billion, despite the fact that most people want to stay there in their own home. The vast majority of those expenditures, about $92 billion, are for institutional care, and only about $42 billion are for home and community-based services. The vast majority of the expenditures are public programs, Medicaid, Medicare. This other is largely other government programs. Private insurance plays a very small role, only about $5.6 billion out of that $135 billion. So this fact that long-term care is expensive, that a large percentage of older people in nursing homes spend down, impoverish themselves. They started out as private pay, but then because nursing home care costs $75,000 or $80,000 a year, end up on Medicaid. The dream has always been that if you can get people to buy private insurance, then you can avoid the impoverishment that people who need long-term care go through, and you can avoid the government expenditures that's necessary to provide them the long-term care. A major barrier for that is that good quality, and I underline the term good quality private long-term care insurance costs at least $2,500 a year. So a married couple is talking about maybe $5,000 a year. That's if you buy the policy at age 65. The median income for households between the ages of 65 and 69 is $38,000. So $5,000 is a big chunk of change to ask older people to put out. One of the ideas to try to get more private insurance is to try to sell it at younger ages. But what are people in their 40s and 50s concerned about? They're concerned about their general retirement, child care, college education for their children, and increasingly how they're going to pay the mortgage. They don't believe they're ever going to need long-term care, and to the extent that they think about it, they improperly think that Medicare will cover it, which it won't. So what should be the balance between nursing home care and home and community-based services? Again, looking at the international comparisons, the yellow is home care, and the blue-purple is institutional care. There has been a growth in the supply of home care over the last 10, 15 years as a number of countries try to create more balanced systems. But institutional care still dominates. The United States is here. In general, countries that provide a lot of institutional care also provide a lot of home care. So here in the United States, there is a remarkable bipartisan consensus to try to change the balance of expenditures and care away from institutions and towards home and community-based services for two basic reasons. One, that's the kind of care that people want. And there is also an unspoken, or largely unspoken, belief that care is better in one's own home than in a nursing home. And that is partly an invidious comparison to nursing home care. There's not really a lot of data on that compares nursing home care and home care, but that's part of the belief. And there's also the belief that home care is cheaper than nursing home care. And that is a very difficult proposition on which there is a large empirical research, much of it, though, quite old. But what that literature shows is that expanding home care increases total expenditures rather than decreases it because many people, given a choice between nursing home care and nothing, would choose nothing, but given a choice between nursing home care, and nothing, choose home care. So large increases in home care use more than offset relatively small reductions in nursing home use. Now, as I said, that literature is quite old, but I urge you to be somewhat skeptical and suspicious of broad claims of cost savings by expanding home care, although there are many, many other reasons to support home care, and I do. It is the service that people want, and I do believe the care is better than in a nursing home. Despite the broad consensus in terms of trying to change this balance, there is more rhetoric than there are dollars among long-term care expenditures for older people. Only 29% of Medicaid expenditures in 2006 were for home and community-based services. Some of the initiatives that states in particular have been putting forth to try to do this rebalancing of the long-term care system include consumer-directed home care, where it's consumers rather than agencies who hire, fire, direct, and schedule the workers. And that's a kind of care that's very prevalent in Wisconsin, Oregon, Michigan, Washington, and Arkansas. There has been an explosion over the last 15 years in terms of residential care facilities such as assisted living. There are now about 800,000 people in residential care facilities compared to about 1.5 million people in nursing homes. And finally, recently, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has given grants to 41 states to implement a so-called money follows the person demonstration, where they're giving money to states basically to go into nursing homes and identify people who don't need to be there and transition them out into the community. Well, my final issue is who will care for us, which circles back to that issue that Dan was talking about at the end of his talk. Direct care workers, such as certified nursing assistants, provide most long-term care services. We have very high turnover and vacancy rates. Turnover rates average 71% a year in nursing homes, and there are a number of states where the turnover rate is over 100% a year. That shortage derives largely from the fact that these are low-paid workers. They make between $7 and $10 an hour. They tend not to have health insurance and any other benefits. They have low levels of education and training. And all of this comes at a cost. It may affect continuity of care, staffing levels in nursing homes. For those of you that may have been at the session earlier today on quality of care in nursing homes, having this kind of turnover has a big impact on the staffing levels. And while the research literature is not all that clear, it may have a big impact on quality of care as well. And the future, as difficult as things are now in terms of the shortage of these kinds of workers, it's only going to get much worse in the future. Right now, there are about 35 people aged 20 to 64, which is basically your working population, to each person age 85 and older, basically the population in need of long-term care services. So it's at 35 now, but it goes down to about 11 in 2050, which means that somehow or another, if we're going to provide services to the people who need them, we're going to have to figure out some way to get many more people into the long-term care workforce than are there now. So when we were sending all these emails around for this session, Dave said that what reporters want is story ideas. So this is my my effort at some story ideas. One is on projected growth in the need and demand for long-term care. We've got to figure out a way to prepare for that. How long-term care is financed and delivered in other countries. I am always amazed at how U.S.-centric the policy discussion is on health care and everything else. There are a lot of other countries that show that there are other ways of organizing and financing long-term care. We should look at it. Stories on initiatives to rebalance long-term care to provide more home and community-based services. Many states have waiting lists for their home care services. This issue of consumer direction, money follows the person, residential care facilities, all of those are, in my opinion, quite underreported. The boom in assisted living facilities, they tend to be expensive, so there's an issue of affordability. They're not well monitored or regulated. What do we know about the quality of care? And one of the attractions is the notion of aging in place, that you stay in the facility and services grow as your need grows. But at what point do you become an unlicensed nursing home and not an assisted living facility? The shortage of workers, clearly a major issue for the future. And then finally, the positions of presidential and other candidates on long-term care financing, quality and delivery. That has been a very unexplored issue. Nobody has really been pressing the candidates on those issues. They talk about their health care reform, but they don't talk about long-term care. So just to conclude, and again following up on Dan's points, when long-term, in 2040, 2050, when all of the baby boom generation needs long-term care is going to be on the cover of Newsweek 26 weeks a year and on the cover of Time the other 26 weeks a year. But we have an opportunity now to try to put it more on the political agenda now. We have a large elderly population that needs long-term care, and they are the parents of the baby boom generation. And we're now at a point where how your mom is doing is sort of run-of-the-mill cocktail party conversation, but it has not yet been transformed into a policy debate, into a debate on how we can make the financing, the delivery, the quality better in a kind of systematic fashion. Thank you. There are handouts in the back, so anyone who's interested.
Okay, well, can you hear me through this?
Yes.
Okay. Let me know if you can't. No? All right. Well, I'm the cleanup, Bob. No, you can't hear. Is that right?
Bring him a little closer.
Okay. All right. How's this? No? Yes. All right. Okay. I can hear it now. All right. Well, in terms of this last segment, so we want to make sure that you had some time for questions. I'm going to distill my comments to three areas, and one is relative to the whole issue of how much people know about long-term care. As ARP has done a study, actually over a period of 2 5-year sequences as to what people really know about this issue that has been pitched by Dan, as well as with Josh's pointing out some of the specific issues. The second point I'll really cover is that of the often felt, but not necessarily fully realized, the caregiving kinds of costs that Josh pointed out are really borne, as many of you probably know, but may not realize it's by the caregivers of informal support. So I wanted to cover that particular area. And then finally, the formal title of my segment had to do with how do you pull both the medical as well as the long-term care side of it, that as we have this growing demographic that Dan had described, what really are the true costs? And when Josh started to talk about the fact that there are Medicare costs, Medicaid costs, out-of-pocket costs, Social Security, you know, what really is this about relative to individuals with the fastest growing population with the 85 plus? So that's what I'll do in a few minutes, and we'll make sure that there are there is plenty of time for questions. One of the things that AARP has been tracking is just the level of knowledge that people have about long-term care. And one thing that was quite dismal this past December, you know, we launched a second report that we had done 5 years previous to that as to how much people knew. And unfortunately, in the course of the 5 year span, the knowledge about long-term care was not known. So I don't know when Josh, for example, slipped in the fact that an average private nursing home bed could cost about $75,000. For how many of you was that a bit of a surprise? Yeah, it is. Most people don't realize that that kind of cost is actually frequently incurred. So a semi-private bed, like having two beds to a nursing home room, the cost there would be about $64,000 out of pocket. One of the things that we continue to affirm is that many people think that the Medicare program covers long-term care, and that continues to prevail amongst many people, that this is what people expect, that because they're 65 and they have this coverage, and once they go to a hospital and after they get discharged, that their so-called long-term care is covered. Well, there's some truth to that, because like right after a hospital episode, so if a person broke his or her hip, they are entitled for some home care that's covered by Medicare. But the kind of issue that of this chronicity, Dan mentioned this, these basically things of everyday living that you have to take care of. I mean, this is not really covered by the Medicare program. And we found consistently that the population does not really know this. The whole aspect of how much home care costs, the fact that people want home care, that just seems to be a very vernacular common thing to wish for. Well, it turns out that many people could not, the majority of the population could not price out what the cost of having 1 hour of home care would run, which could actually run close to $20 an hour. So if it's $20 an hour, and you are fortunate to get 4 hours of care a day, that amounts to $27,000 just for possibly up to 4 hours. And we're not talking about nursing care. We're talking about somebody who has some skills in providing some support care of bathing and eating and things of that nature. And that's almost $20 an hour. So this is one of the things that is just really quite surprising to many people. And so this is a real sleeper. We talk so much about the cost of health care, and that's what all of you cover. But this hidden under the iceberg issue of what it costs over time, especially as people continue to live longer, is an issue. So I leave this point with the fact that through AARP, we do have this report available both online as well as available in hard copy if you would like. The second point that I wanted to bring up has to do with that of caregivers. And, you know, a lot of narrative is about caregivers in these days, and it begins to slip into from the long-term care side to the acute care side. And part of it is just the hidden burden of costs that go on to caregivers. Right now, when we describe all the care that is being described by Josh relative to care in the community or care in nursing homes, you know, when we talk about 800,000 people in the community and 1.5 or 1.6 million people who are in nursing homes, that's only 20% of where caregiving occurs. The other 80% is informal care. And some of you probably are caregivers yourselves or have family members who are caregivers. And what has happened is that over 90% of people have actually given up either full-time or some part-time employment to be caregivers in some form. So there's a huge economic aspect that is much more of the ecology of what happens to our economic base. I just do a little sidebar comment here that many of these caregivers are women, as is commonly known. And that actually has a major impact on another social insurance program, such as Social Security, because over the course of an average caregiver's lifetime, they give up more than $500,000 of earned income during that time. And that affects the amount that they put into Social Security as a worker, and number two, the ability to vest in an IRA or some other kind of workforce aspect really starts decreasing their income. So when we talk about long-term care or medical care, we don't always really consider is the economic impact of what happens to the caregiver over a period of time. So I just want to lead you to the thought that it's both healthcare impact, and there are enough studies to show the effect on the caregiver's health and well-being to having chronic illnesses really appear much more rapidly in the caregiver than somebody who wasn't a caregiver, and the pure economic impact to that family. And that's part of the reason, from a policy standpoint, Josh ended up with a couple of slides about the kinds of programs that are being tested right now, that there are cash benefits that are being tested to give to somebody who's qualified for some kind of long-term care, especially Medicaid. And this money now, in some places, is being allowed to pay caregivers, pay family members. And so the fact that this becomes an economic as well as a care model is beginning to occur. And that actually, there's an interesting story, I think, that's considered historically, and Josh, you may know a lot more about this. Historically, our policy, in some ways, our explicit policy was not to pay family members. Family members and this 80% of informal care is really kind of a family responsibility. Looking internationally, some of the countries actually require, I think it's in France, that they require the children to be financially responsible for their parents. So there's some explicit policies that family members are to provide this care. Well, what has happened, I think, in our own country, that state by state, different kinds of policies have shifted. When you start giving the cash benefit called consumer-directed care, and you can pay your family member, we have slipped into a direction of a policy where we are willing to look at this as a caregiving situation. Now, there are ups and downs about this story because California as a state was one of the first states to really make this an explicit policy. And what was quite interesting in there is there was high degree of satisfaction by the beneficiaries who received this. And many of the, and again, with a diverse state like California, it's always difficult enough to get caregivers because of you hear about the churn of having workers from 71% to 100% in the nursing home. But even in the community setting, people would churn. And we found that there was greater continuity of care just because these are family members, but because there are also large populations of people who don't speak English, the ability to recruit workers who would be bilingual, bicultural is extremely difficult. But when you are allowed to pay a relative or family member, you have cultural and linguistic compatibility. And as a result, I think Ted Benjamin from UCLA did a study to show the high degree of satisfaction that occurred with that particular program. Those of us in the past who were more formal organizations who recruited and paid and supervised people, we were wondering whether or not there might be some concern about inappropriateness relative to care. But by and large, that has not been found to be true. Of course, there always will be some of that, but by and large, that has not been the case. So the caregiver issue is one of those issues that isn't always talked as kind of frontally as a policy issue, but you know there are big bucks involved here. And the dollars include the fact that it's $350 billion has been estimated. So when Josh had the slide up of about $150 million was involved in some of the long-term care costs, you know, what the caregivers provide is actually far more. So there's a big comparison of if we, as people grow older and they're more volume, what do we do? Well, let me end with the last segment, which was integrated care. And a lot will actually be showing up a lot, or much will be showing up in the report coming from the Institute of Medicine on geriatric professionals. And it speaks to one segment of it is about the PACE program that I've been affiliated with for 25 years. This is where I'd say in a few minutes is a program that looked at long-term care issues really from a community standpoint to start with, not from a policy wonk perspective, but this is what happened to people. And we were, in just a nutshell, able to get money from the Medicare side and money from the Medicaid side, blended it together, and created a service delivery system where we were responsible for the entire individual. So when you hear about issues of fee-for-service payment systems in Medicare or using nursing home for the Medicaid side of it, we basically just took the money side and blended it together and created a delivery system that covered whatever statutorily would be required it to be covered under Medicare, and then also what was required to be covered under Medicaid, and blended it together. But this is an example where the community-based services range from, you know, getting transportation to getting a meal at home. But what we were able to do is create a transformative way of looking at using the money and being responsible for outcomes. A good example is we would pay for money, we would pay for eyeglasses or hearing aids with this blended fund and make sure that the person was able to stay in the community. What we're able to obviate is an example of a hospitalization because somebody fell for a hip fracture. And so, you know, going to the hospital and the medical costs for a hip fracture that CDC just reported on today on a session that I went to is $58,000. So instead of paying $58,000, we sent home a meal. We had them come to a day center. We made sure they had a pair of eyeglasses. They could hear. We made sure that there were no rugs slipping around in their home. That, compared to $58,000, is a very different return on investment. And so that basically is, in essence, part of the model. I just wanted to end with the fact that right now it's in 22 states. By the end of this year, there will be in 27 states, and this is a project right now that has been passed through legislation, but it was an example of using what I would call common sense, which is not something that you speak of really from a policy standpoint, but with the evidence from cost, quality, and satisfaction. And bottom line is, you know, the turnover rates of the lowest paid workers, we only had a 12% turnover per year. So we had the continuity. We could address quality. We could address sustainability. So I'll end with that because it's going to be in the IOM report, and it's also available online. Thank you.
We have a few minutes for questions. If you have a question, try to use the mic in the center of the room because we're taping. And otherwise, we'll stick around up here for a few minutes till we get thrown out by the next panel. But any questions, please step up to the mic. And otherwise, thanks for coming by. And if you can give us your name and where you're working too.
My name is Barbara Glickstein. I'm a public health nurse and broadcast journalist. Radio, public radio in New York City, and Martha Stewart Living Radio, Sirius Satellite. My question is, I didn't attend the early morning medical tourism workshop. However, I have interviewed an entrepreneur who is developing nursing homes in China that he called were equivalent to five-star hotels in the best places in, around the world, and that, in fact, it would be cheaper to fly to China to visit your grandparents or parents as opposed to housing them here in that quality of care. Are you familiar with it? I see you're shaking your head. And can you comment about exporting our parents to other worlds for their care as elders?
Well, Josh, you may have some comments. You know, the Japanese used to do that. The Japanese would export their elders to Hawaii because at that point it used to be cheaper to do that than to provide some care in Japan at the time. And I do know that this phenomenon of assisted living companies from the U.S. are actually developing businesses in China to do this. So from a cost standpoint and all, yes, there's from a pure dollar standpoint, that's there. You know, some people are a little bit concerned just about the kind of difference in regulation, but, you know, certainly the U.S. dollar, you know, goes much, much further there, in, especially in Guangzhou, which is in the Canton region where this is fairly common. But it's again, kind of parallel to the medical tourism, as you were saying, except that this is a place where somebody lives, you know, basically for the rest of their life. And so there's just some cautions I've heard relative to, because the regulation is not the same, but you could buy services much less.
Go ahead.
While it may be possible to do it at lower cost, I fear for the nursing home resident who is visited once a year on a trip.
That's nice.
The family that comes into the nursing home on a daily, weekly basis is the most important aspect of assuring quality of care. It's that family tie that is really important. And, you know, I guess I don't have any objection to people going and, you know, while they're healthy, wealthy, and wise, off to foreign countries to live, but the fact of the matter is the vast majority of people who have disabilities are within 10 miles of their children, and you know, they're there to help their parents and to provide care, and I guess I would just, you know, five-star hotel sounds good to me, but I guess I would worry about the quality of care and the quality of the human interaction.
I turned it off.
I was in China a couple of years ago as part of a delegation of people looking at elder care facilities from those in the community to hospital-based care for the elderly. I didn't see many five-star hotel types. In fact, it was pretty primitive. And this is a country that now has crossed the 10% mark in terms of people living beyond the age of 60. And when you've got 1.4 billion, that starts getting to some real numbers. And in the not-distant future, next 20 years, they could have as many people over the age of 60 as we have people. And they are nowhere ready to be able to deal with that. There is nothing like we would consider under, there's no such thing as Medicare in China. There's no such thing as Social Security as we know it. The differences between those that are living in urban areas and those that are living in far-flung rural areas are dramatic. And believe me, I think that it's going to be one of the biggest problems that's going to tie China in knots as it tries to realize its full economic and potential as a nation over the next 40 years is what to do with all these old folks. And I think the idea of American elders going to China looking for better care than they're going to get in their own community is a little topsy-turvy.
Another question?
Yes, I have a question for Jenny Hansen. My name is Genevieve Silverio with the Asian Journal in San Diego. You had mentioned a program called PACE. Is that right? Okay. And my perception is there has been a lot of adult daycare facilities popping up all over San Diego, and I just want to know what kind of oversight is being done to watch how many people, because I was at one facility and there were so many people seated at a table. They looked like kindergarten. It looked like a kindergarten class, and they were had to sit there for 4 hours. I was just wondering, how do you address that?
Right. Well, adult day health is, for those people who aren't familiar with it, it's generally a licensed program in most states whereby elders who tend to have some degree of disability, but whether it's functional or cognitive, have a chance to come in and they get some nursing services and some therapy services. In California, it's a fairly regulated program, and there is a licensing process, one, to even get it started for the bricks and mortar and for the staffing, and they're supposed to have regular reviews. I know that CMS right now is putting a bit of a slowdown on this just because the variation of these programs across the country is so different. But, yes, some states have this as a highly regulated program and paid for on a per diem basis by Medicaid.
I just wanted to add that, in general, home and community-based services are much less regulated and monitored than nursing home care. For nursing homes, you walk into the facility, all the providers, all the records, all the residents are right there. If you're doing something with home care, by definition, it's extremely dispersed and the providers are dispersed, and it's very expensive to gather information about how care is being provided. But as we move the expenditures more and more to the home care side, I think it's going to be necessary to figure out what we're going to do in terms of monitoring and assuring that the quality is good.
Dan, anything to add? I think we have time for one more quick one, and after that we'll get out of the way of the next panel, but we'll just hang out down there for a few minutes for more questions. Go ahead.
This is a question for Jenny Chin Hansen. My name is Joan Aragone, and I do a write about seniors for the San Mateo County Times of California. My question is about PACE. You said it's in 22 states. It's going to be in 27.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what entities adopt it, because I know it's in San Francisco in one organization, but how does PACE enter a state? Is it adopted by a senior network or hospitals, or how does that happen?
I'll give you, first of all, a short answer. In fact, all the programs right now that operate a PACE come from a not-for-profit basis. The original program started as standalone not-for-profit entities. More and more of them are being actually started by hospital entities that oftentimes are religious orders. And they also tend to be, some of them are publicly connected entities as well. So they're housed sometimes in a larger institution, but a large one, Johns Hopkins, for example, has a PACE program. Fallon Healthcare in Massachusetts operates one. So there are different sponsoring entities, but I think the common denominator, they are 501Cs or not-for-profit entities. And then in terms of how does one start one, basically whoever the sponsoring entity is, then the state Medicaid system has to agree that they would allow a PACE to operate, and there has to be a federal contract with CMS. So it's a three-party contract, federal, state, and provider, in order to make that possible.
Okay, one more thank you for our panel, and we'll get it put you down there. And we have handouts from Josh and Dan in the back, and if anyone wants, I have an electronic copy of Jenny's outline. Give me your card, and I'll email it to you today. Thanks.